Hi, I'm Vika Aronson, podcast producer for the PBS NewsHour. And before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about another podcast from one of our promotional partners, Unlocking Bryson's Brain from CBC Podcasts. Unlocking Bryson's Brain is the true story of 13-year-old Bryson, who is a happy, loving boy, but a mysterious disease means he can't walk, talk, or feed himself. After years without a diagnosis, genetic scientists believe they know what's causing Bryson's illness and think it can be reversed. You can join Bryson's family on their search for a medical miracle in Unlocking Bryson's Brain. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The coronavirus conundrum. The widespread relaxing of restrictions continues as new hotspots emerge and the death toll in the United States tops 90,000. Then, the diplomatic angle. China flexes its muscles on the world stage, pushing to aid the global coronavirus response while derailing investigations into the early stages of the pandemic. And COVID and college. The pandemic highlights inequities in aptitude testing for college admissions and hastens a nationwide move away from them.
Students today take the SAT during the spring, during the school day. That's about 700,000 students who missed that chance.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Major new developments tonight in the COVID-19 pandemic. The United States reaches 90,000 deaths out of 1.5 million cases as more of the country loosens restrictions. There is potentially promising news about a possible vaccine. And President Trump drops his own medical bombshell. John Yang begins our coverage.
While meeting with food industry executives at the White House today, President Trump made a startling disclosure. He's been taking the controversial drug hydroxychloroquine as a preventive against COVID-19.
So I'm taking the two, the zinc and the hydroxy, and all I can tell you is, so far, I seem to be okay.
The president's use of the drug outside a hospital setting goes against the Food and Drug Administration's warning about the risk of heart problems. Mr. Trump has long touted the anti-malaria medication's potential, even though its effectiveness is unproven. He made the disclosure amid possible signs of progress on a vaccine. Drug maker Moderna reported that limited data from early human testing suggests its experimental product is safe and triggers an immune response. This all comes as the nation takes tentative steps toward reopening. Before dawn in Michigan today, Fiat Chrysler auto workers returned to work for the first time since this plant closed in mid-March due to COVID-19.
Everybody's going to have to take their temperature daily and fill out that screening, and they'll have to go through the same screening process every morning when they come to work.
Michigan recorded 11 new deaths Sunday, the lowest since March 24th. Governor Gretchen Whitmer said that in coming days, some counties could lift restrictions.
So I want to encourage everyone to stay smart and to stay safe.
States like Florida and Massachusetts are issuing their own guidance on a gradual reopening. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis announced that gyms and fitness centers can resume operations and restaurants can open at 50% capacity. San Francisco took a small step today, allowing retailers to reopen with curbside pickup. But in the epicenter of the country's outbreak, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio warned that lifting safety measures too quickly will lead to more infections.
We cannot have a boomerang. We cannot have something where we have to shut down again.
But across the country, some are defying measures meant to stop the spread of coronavirus. Several protesters stood outside a New Jersey strip mall this morning in support of a gym that opened in defiance of state guidance. Gym co-owner Ian Smith insisted it's safe and that proper safety precautions are in place.
The gym has been sanitized top to bottom by a professional cleaning crew. Everything in the gym is 6 feet apart. Everything is clearly marked. There will be masks.
COVID-19 is taking center stage at the annual assembly held by video conference this year of the 194-member World Health Organization. China's President Xi Jinping today pledged $2 billion over 2 years to support worldwide recovery efforts. In Washington, the White House dismissed that as a token to distract from China's failure to warn the world of what was coming. And the WHO is facing questions about how it handled the pandemic. The European Union, along with countries like the United Kingdom and New Zealand, are pushing for a probe of the response. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern.
Because this is one that does not seek to lay blame. It seeks to learn from an experience that I think every citizen around the world would know we would need to learn from.
Across hard-hit Italy, signs of new normalcy as churches, shops, and even Venice's gondolas reopened today. A nun and a priest, both wearing masks, entered St. Peter's Basilica today, open to the public for the first time in nearly 3 months. And in Denmark, for the first time in months, some enjoyed a cup of coffee brewed outside their kitchens as cafes and restaurants resumed service. The country was the first in Europe to enter a lockdown in March and was the first to begin easing those rules last month. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
Reports of positive results from an experimental vaccine boosted Wall Street today. So did oil prices, closing above $30 a barrel for the first time in 2 months. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 900 points, nearly 4%, to close near 24,600. The Nasdaq rose 220 points, and the S&P 500 added 90. Today, the World Health Organization hosted an annual summit designed for world leaders to coordinate in their fight against COVID-19. But the World Health Assembly was dominated by tensions between the U.S. and China and criticisms by the rest of the world of a vacuum of global leadership. Nick Schifrin joins me now. So, Nick, what is this main central tension between the U.S. and China?
Judy, the World Health Assembly basically became a proxy battle for the political tensions between the United States and China. So what we heard today was much of what we heard over the last few months, tensions between these two countries over the origins of the virus, over the worldwide leadership of this crisis, and of course, whether the WHO itself did a good job. Now, Xi Jinping was the first world leader to speak. He promised to share any Chinese vaccine with the world. He pledged $2 billion for the entire world for COVID-19, and he defended the WHO and China's efforts.
We've acted with openness, transparency, and responsibility. We've provided information to WHO and relevant countries in a most timely fashion. We have released the genome sequence at the earliest possible time.
And she's really responding, of course, to U.S. criticisms that in the early days of this outbreak, local authorities silenced doctors and Beijing authorities centralized or even destroyed some of the virus samples. So what did we hear from the U.S.? That was led by Alex Azar, Secretary of Health and Human Services. He gave a short speech, but right out of the bat, blamed the WHO and China.
In an apparent attempt to conceal this outbreak, at least one member state made a mockery of their transparency obligations, with tremendous cost for the entire world. We saw that WHO failed at its core mission of information sharing and transparency when member states do not act in good faith. This cannot ever happen again.
So, Nick, we know, listening to Secretary Azar just now, the U.S. has been talking about reforms so that this doesn't happen again. Have any of those reforms been adopted?
In a word, no, Judy, at least not yet. So the U.S. has wanted Taiwan to become an observer at the WHO, and the U.S. has wanted fundamental reforms to the WHO, allowing it to enforce countries reporting their outbreaks early on that the U.S. says China did not do. Both of those efforts were shelved even before this assembly began. U.S. officials telling me that they're going to try again later this year, and this wasn't really the ideal venue in order to do do that. Where the U.S. believes it succeeded was to get China to agree to an investigation into COVID-19. But Judy, this is important. In order to get that resolution passed, it was watered down. It does not mention the word China. It does not mention the word Wuhan, nor does it call for an investigation into the origin of the disease. Instead, all it calls for is the international community to identify the animal source of the virus, determine how it entered humans, and to create a kind of lessons learned project, but only after the pandemic ends.
And Nick, outside the U.S. and China, what did other countries say?
Many other countries, Judy, defended the WHO and called for global solidarity, including U.S. allies, countries that the U.S. will need in order to pressure China, namely France and Germany. Now, there was a real battle here over global leadership. Xi Jinping emphasized the money he was giving, emphasized solidarity. Secretary Azar emphasized neither point. And what the U.S. officials I talked to say is, look, we have already pledged $2 billion to the world, on top of $10 billion that the U.S. pledges every year, on $100 billion that the U.S. has been given to Africa. But none of that was highlighted today. And so China might not give more money, Judy, but even the U.S. officials I'm talking to admit that it advertises better and it prioritizes events like today much more than the U.S. ever has.
And Nick, a different subject, but also the U.S. and China, and that is tensions between the two countries over the tech giant Huawei. How has the U.S. in the last few days been increasing pressure over this?
Yeah, Huawei's really at this technological battle. Huawei's a $100 billion phone and technology juggernaut. And the U.S. took the most aggressive steps that it has against Huawei, as much of a mortal blow to the company as the U.S. is capable of delivering. Basically, any supplier, whether foreign or the U.S., that makes chips for Huawei, measures chips for Huawei, sells any technology at all to Huawei, if that supplier has any U.S. intellectual property, even like the software that runs the machine that prints the chips, that company will now not be able to sell to Huawei unless it gets a U.S. exemption. The experts I talked to say this will set Huawei back about 18 months and cost them a considerable amount of money. Huawei admitted today that it would set them back, but also said that Beijing wouldn't sit back and let the U.S. destroy the company, Judy. So expect some kind of retaliation from China, perhaps against U.S. companies that still rely on Chinese supply chains in what really has become a technological cold war.
A lot going on between the U.S. and China right now. Nick Schifrin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, federal officials say that a Saudi gunman who opened fire at a U.S. naval base in Pensacola, Florida last December had ties to al-Qaeda. The Saudi officer killed three sailors before being killed himself. FBI Director Christopher Wray says that data recovered from the gunman's cell phone shows links to al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen, known as AQAP.
He wasn't just coordinating with them about planning and tactics. He was helping the organization make the most it could out of his murders. And he continued to confer with his AQAP associates right up until the end, the very night before he started shooting.
Director Wray and Attorney General William Barr both sharply criticized Apple for not helping unlock the gunman's smartphone. It took FBI agents 4 months to break the encryption. Attorney General Barr also says that he does not expect criminal probes of former President Obama or former Vice President Biden. President Trump has claimed that they may have committed crimes related to launching the Russia investigation. Barr dismissed that claim today as he discussed U.S. Attorney John Durham's review of the investigation.
As to President Obama and Vice President Biden, whatever their level of involvement, based on the information I have today, I don't expect Mr. Durham's work will lead to a criminal investigation of either man. Our concern over potential criminality is focused on others.
President Trump said later that he's surprised that Barr is not planning criminal probes of Obama and Biden. Democrats say that the Friday night firing of the State Department's inspector general may be linked to a Saudi arms deal. Representative Elliot Engel, chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said today that Inspector General Steve Linnick was investigating the $7 billion deal. President Trump says that he does not know Linnick, but Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wanted him fired. We'll explore this further later in the program. A federal prosecutor who oversaw cases against two Trump allies could be getting a big promotion. It is widely reported that U.S. Attorney Tim Shea will take over the Drug Enforcement Administration. Shea had helped push for a lighter sentence for Roger Stone, a Trump friend and advisor, and for dismissing criminal charges against Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor. In Israel, a Jewish extremist was convicted today of murdering an 18-month-old Palestinian boy and his parents. The court found the defendant threw firebombs into the family's West Bank home as they slept in 2015. The boy's grandfather welcomed the conviction.
The trial will not bring my family back, but I don't want there to be more children to go through the trauma that we went through. We went through this trauma for 5 years, a whole year at the hospital, and I don't want another family to go through this. Enough already.
Defense lawyers claim that police used torture to force a confession, but they offered no evidence. Back in this country, voters in Wisconsin who have disabilities or belong to a minority filed a federal lawsuit over the upcoming August primary and November general election. They want more poll workers, as well as absentee ballots for all voters, among other things. Wisconsin held its presidential primary last month, despite fears of the coronavirus. And the year's first named storm in the Atlantic swirled off the coast of North Carolina. Today, the tropical storm named Arthur brought heavy rain and rough surf to the Outer Banks before turning out to sea. Hurricane season doesn't officially begin until June 1st. Still to come on the NewsHour, public health concerns remain as more and more states relax restrictions on public gatherings. The Trump administration fires a State Department watchdog, the latest in its dismantling of oversight. How the pandemic hastens a nationwide move away from aptitude testing for college admissions, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The coronavirus pandemic has turned life as we know it upside down.
We're in the United States of America, and you think to yourself, how in the hell did we let this happen?
How are our communities, our jobs, and our daily lives changing? And where do we go from here?
We've spent billions of dollars hunting down terrorist cells. We don't do that with pandemics. That's the wrong approach.
America Interrupted, a new original podcast series from the PBS NewsHour, available wherever you get your podcasts.
In all but two states, stay-at-home orders are being lifted. Many states are still restricting how widely they will reopen and only will do so gradually. But there is no doubt questions are increasingly focused on how that can be done while minimizing risk to public health. Dr. Atul Gawande is focused on that, and it's the subject of a piece he wrote for the New Yorker website. He's a surgeon at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and chairman of Haven. It's a joint healthcare venture created by Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and J.P. Morgan. And he joins us from Boston. Dr. Gawande, it's so good to have you with us. Again, you are reminding people that even as we move ahead, it's important to keep the basics in mind. So tell us again, what are the basics?
Well, I think the basics come from the fact that there have been a group of workers who have been going to work right through this epidemic, and those are healthcare workers. And we've managed in the United States to make it so we can go to work and not spread the virus. And there are four components to what I've called a combination therapy. The components are ones you all know, but each of them are flawed. But when you put them together, it stops the virus, and we're demonstrating that in healthcare. So what are they? Number one is hygiene. Number two is distancing. Number three is screening, screening people for even very mild symptoms so they stay home rather than going to work. And fourth are masks. And the main value of the masks is that we can spread the disease, we now know, before we've developed symptoms. And the best way to keep from infecting other people is a mask, because it's our respiratory droplets. When we talk, when we breathe, when we cough, that we have the ability to spread the virus.
Assuming they can get the test and have access to the test. But as you look around the country, Dr. Gawande, and you see how these states are opening up, and as we said, most of them are now trying to open up to one degree or another, what do you see that gives you hope, that makes you feel reassured, and what do you see that's worrying you?
So the things that give me hope, number one, we are finding that we have managed to lock down successfully enough that we did not exceed the hospital capacity. And in most parts of the country, there's enough hospital capacity for the capability to open up. Number two is that we have testing capacity actually has increased significantly. In a lot of parts of the country, reports are now coming out in many states that we haven't used up the capacity enough. People aren't coming in for the tests, and we need to, you know, call up your doctor or go to your, you know, one of these drive-through spots. CVS has them, Rite Aid, Walgreens, and get tested if you have even the slightest symptoms. Those are what gives me good news, is we are climbing and that's getting better. Now, what am I worried about? What I'm worried about is that, you know, we're having this debate about our culture of what we're going to do to secure safety for one another. It's a debate that's about safety and freedom, right? Keep me safe, leave me alone. And we're putting too much emphasis on the minority who are, you know, refusing to participate. The reality is, if the vast majority of us, if we get even just 60% wearing masks that are 60% effective, that's to say they're double layer cotton at least and fit well, then we can avoid spreading infection to other people. The value is I protect you, you protect me. And we don't have to all be perfect. We don't have to be vigilantes about it, but we do have to build a culture where we feel my job is that I never want to be the one to put you in the hospital. I never want to be that person. That's the culture of healthcare that we've built that keeps us safe. When we go into work at a place that has risk, and we've managed to avoid turning hospitals into places of spread.
And that even as we are keeping ourselves safe, we need to constantly remember how important it is to keep others safe as well. Dr. Gawande, I also want to ask you about the news today that has given investors hope. We see the markets going up today because there are reports that progress seems to be made in the very early stages of a vaccine. Put that in context for us. What are you seeing? How much hope should we have at this point about a vaccine, and when?
Well, first, I got to say, it is extraordinary to see the progress that's happened to this point. You're absolutely right. This is just the first step on a multi-stage journey. But, you know, the fact that you have three companies now, you have a Chinese vaccine, an Oxford vaccine, and this one from Moderna here in Boston. And all three have not only been produced, they have gone into trial and already have some early results in the first few weeks that is an indication, not that they work yet, but, you know, that would have taken, in previous times, 3 to 5 years. This happened in weeks. I mean, that's stunning. Now, the entire vaccine process from concept to finish, my vaccine colleagues tell me, you know, it's never been done in less than 20 years before. So the fact that we've got this front end already at the stage, and that we'll have others coming out into the summer, 100 vaccines that are coming out into tests, it does give a lot of hope that within a couple of years, we could be into production. Is this a matter of just months away? No, I think we have to be ready for that. And being ready for it means being ready to understand. We all have to take seriously really learning how to take what works. And if we are gonna come out and work together and be with one another, we got to be able to do those basic steps and work together on that.
One other thing I want to ask you, and that is, we've just learned today, President Trump says that for the last week and a half to 2 weeks, he's been taking the drug hydroxychloroquine, I guess typically prescribed for malaria, but he's taking it prophylactically. What do you make of that?
Well, there have been multiple trials, studies now. They have so far shown no benefit from hydroxychloroquine, and one has shown that there is serious heart risks from the drug. So as a physician, I am not advising to patients that this is a good idea. There'll be better trials to come. But right now, there's no evidence it works in it, and in fact, it could be harmful.
Dr. Atul Gawande, thank you very much. It's always good to have you with us. Thank you.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
President Trump has fired three federal government official watchdogs in the past 6 weeks. These are inspectors general, and the most recent is the Inspector General of the State Department, Steve Linnick, just last Friday. Today, the chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee, Representative Elliot Engel, said that Linnick was investigating the Trump administration fast-tracking weapon sales to Saudi Arabia last year. Engel and Democratic Senator Bob Menendez are reviewing Linnick's firing. Yamiche Alcindor takes a closer look.
Some see the firings as a threat to the independent government watchdogs. President Trump says many of the people he removed were too partisan. The most recent firing comes after President Trump removed or replaced inspectors general for the intelligence community, the Defense Department, and the Department of Health and Human Services. Joining me now to talk about the role of inspectors general is Joel Brenner. He was an IG for the National Security Agency under President George W. Bush. And from 2006 to 2009, he was the head of the U.S. counterintelligence under the Director of National Intelligence. He also served under President Obama. Thanks so much, Joel, for being here. I want to first play what President Trump had to say at the White House when he was talking about the State Department IG and talking about the fact that, of course, he was fired after there were reports that surfaced that he was looking into an arms trading deal with Saudi Arabia, as well as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's personal conduct. Here's what he said.
I don't know him at all. I never even heard of him. But I was asked to by the State Department, by Mike. I offered most of my people, almost all of them. I said, you know, these are Obama appointees, and if you'd like to let him go, I think you should let him go. But that's up to you, because it's my right to do it. I said, sure, I'll do it. I've gotten rid of a lot of inspector generals. Every president has.
How concerned are you, Joel, about the president firing these IGs, and how unusual is it for him to remove these inspectors general?
I'm very concerned, and it's highly unusual, Yamiche. These are people who were appointed under statute without regard to their political affiliation, solely on the basis of demonstrated ability in law or auditing or similar areas. And the idea that it's typical to turn that these jobs would turn over when a new administration comes in is all wrong. What we're seeing is not only an attack on particular IGs who are uncovering exactly what they were meant to uncover, we're seeing an attack on the institution of IGs itself. And that is, we've never seen before. The institution of IGs in the civilian government's 42 years old. It was a post-Watergate reform designed to uncover malfeasance in the executive branch of the government. The president appears to believe that the Congress has no authority to inquire or interfere with how he does business in the executive branch. I think this is the closest we've come to a Louis XIV theory of American government, which is, I am the state. No Supreme Court's ever agreed with that.
Well, you're talking about the fact that these removals are unusual. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also said that he had no idea what the inspector general at the State Department was looking into. How credible is it that a potential target of an investigation wouldn't know about that investigation?
Well, an investigation it's possible. But I think it's fundamentally incredible that the secretary wouldn't know this. The investigation, according to accounts in the media, have been going on for some time. When you do an investigation, you interview people, you find out things, you ask for documents. It is inconceivable to me that Those stories would not have percolated up to the secretary's office on the top floor of the State Department. Absolutely incredible.
Some lawmakers are already looking at this latest removal. What role, if at all, should Congress play when it comes to these dismissals? And should Congress change the law so that inspectors general are maybe more insulated from political appointees and more insulated from getting fired by presidents?
Well, they are political appointees, and they have to be. You know, this is an executive branch official. The Congress has created a position, but it's a position in the executive branch. And Congress can't direct how that person is going to carry out his or her functions. That's something for the head of the agency to do. But what we've had is, again, an attack on a common understanding, a norm, if you will, about how the government should be conducted. That's what the president's breaking and attacking. That if we have a president who is determined to undermine the law, and if we have a Congress that will not stand up for its own institutional prerogatives, then our republic's in trouble. And right now we have a majority in the Senate that is firmly on the rug under President Trump's couch. And unless they get out from under that couch, we got a problem. Nothing's going to happen, in my view, until we have a change in the government.
And we only have about 30 seconds left here, but I want to ask you, the president says that he is defending himself because these were Obama holdovers. What do you make of President Trump's defense?
Well, as I've suggested, that isn't a defense. The idea was that you would put in persons who were noted for their nonpartisan expertise. There has been a tradition that these jobs do not turn over every time there's a new administration. But the idea that the president is simply ought to be changing IGs because he has the right to do it is exactly the opposite of what the statute intended.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Joel Brenner, a former IG himself.
You're welcome.
Springtime for juniors in high school usually marks the beginning of the college admissions process, with SAT and ACT tests and advanced placement exams. More than 2 million students took AP exams last week, but a glitch prevented thousands from submitting their exams, which were administered online for the first time this year. All this is raising questions about what to do with testing for the class of 2021 and beyond. Stephanie Tsai looks at how the coronavirus is changing the calculus for college hopefuls.
Schools are closed. Classes are online. Students around the country have been forced to make adjustments. One unanticipated change during this pandemic, canceled college admissions tests.
It's given me a lot of anxiety, not knowing that I can take this test or when I'll be able to take it.
In Alexandria, Virginia, Bridget Adu-Wadier had planned to take the SAT for the first time this spring at her high school. Now she worries rescheduling the test won't be easy.
My family doesn't have a car, so figuring out public transportation and bus routes and train routes, especially when the testing location is in a different city several miles away, is really complicated and the costs do add up.
Annette Rooney from Salt Lake City was hoping to take the ACT a second time to improve on her score and have a better shot at top-tier schools.
I am a person that likes to get things done ahead of time, and so I wanted to get my college applications done by the end of summer. And now that I don't have scores that I feel good about, it's like, when am I gonna be able to send in my applications.
New SAT testing dates and sites have been added in the fall, according to David Coleman, CEO of the College Board, which administers the test.
Many students today take the SAT during the spring, during the school day. That's about 700,000 students who missed that chance. We've also said if school doesn't reopen, that we will provide an SAT at home just as we're providing the AP exams at home.
The College Board redesigned its advanced placement tests so students could take them online this month. But critics argue that an online format for the APs and SATs will only exacerbate inequalities. David Coleman acknowledges the challenges.
Some students have lost family members. Some students are in crowded homes. This is not a time to simply look at a measure and judge someone. It's only part of the puzzle.
Tamir Harper founded the nonprofit Herb Ed in Philadelphia and says schools should stop relying on the SAT altogether.
The test was not made for Black and brown students and students of lower economic status. It is 100% unfair.
Do you view this pandemic in a way as a wake-up call to these institutions of higher learning to see the inequities that have been laid bare?
I think it's highlighting inequities across the board, from healthcare to work, even to education. While it's very tragic, it's doing something that will hopefully change the way we look at education.
Now, dozens of colleges and universities like Cornell, Williams, and the entire University of California system are going test optional for the first time. Michelle McEnany is a college admissions specialist and founder of the College Spy.
A test optional admissions policy allows a student to apply to a college without submitting their ACT or SAT scores. The way that works is the college looks at the other parts of their application to evaluate whether they'd be a good fit for campus.
She says going test optional can also be beneficial for the schools.
They get a lot more applications. So then they reject more students because they have a certain number of places in the freshman class. And then they also appear more selective because they have a high rate of rejection.
Seattle University Provost Shane Martin says the school was already considering going test optional, but the COVID-19 pandemic accelerated their decision.
What reasons drove your college's decision to go test optional in these times?
There's evidence that suggests that these tests are biased towards certain groups and that they're not entirely predictive of success in college for high school students.
Martin believes test optional schools will eventually be in the majority.
When you see institutions with strong reputations like the University of Chicago move to test optional, that's a game changer for higher education. And we're going to see more institutions following suit.
For now, McEnany says the tests are still critical for many students, including those that are hoping for scholarships.
Students really shouldn't be saying, you know, I don't have to worry about this because the schools I'm interested in are test optional. If your schools are test optional and your scores are great for that college, you should be submitting your scores. It could help you get in and it could help you get merited.
So many people are smart, or they have the grades that they're comfortable with because they work hard, and just one test that you take on a Saturday doesn't really measure that.
John Barnes of Arlington, Virginia says the tests are an unreliable indicator of student achievement and create too much pressure on students.
I got my score back and it like went down 20 points. So I just started freaking out, and then this security guard comes out. This test has driven me to go this insane that a library security guard had to come out of the library while I'm having a nervous breakdown.
David Kong, a junior in Austin, Texas, feels the opposite.
I moved here from Korea like right before high school started, so I just jumped right in here. And I really had a rocky start, so my GPA isn't all that great compared to my SAT scores.
Coleman says the evidence in favor of the SAT is overwhelming.
If you put a strong score together with strong grades, admissions officers have more confidence about your background. So it is a good thing to have a measure that allows you to better compare people if used humanely in the context in which people live and learn.
And while some students disagree with the emphasis on testing, they recognize the importance of a good score in the current system, whether to get into their dream school.
A number does not determine your future, which is something that I've tried to accept, but it's hard because it still determines your future, kind of.
Or to earn financial aid.
My parents aren't the highest income, and I'm really worried about them taking on debt. I want to make sure that it's not as big of a burden for me, and the SAT was really something that I was counting on.
The class of 2021 looking for clarity for their future in the chaos of a pandemic. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
And a postscript to Stephanie's report. There is more criticism of how the College Board has handled the AP exams taken at home. The board says less than 1% of students were not able to submit their exams. Students can take a makeup next month. The board also says that it tried to lay out specific guidance before the exams began. But some parents and critics have said the board has not been transparent enough about just how many students were affected. Some are angry about students having to take a makeup exam. We are posting a fuller response from the College Board on our website. President Trump has intensified his attacks on former President Obama in recent weeks on issues ranging from pandemic preparedness to the FBI's investigation of Michael Flynn. On Saturday, President Obama appeared to respond during his online address to this year's high school graduates.
Doing what feels good, what's convenient, what's easy, that's how little kids think. Unfortunately, a lot of so-called grown-ups, including some with fancy titles and important jobs, still think that way, which is why things are so screwed up. You know, all those adults that you used to think were in charge and knew what they were doing? Turns out they don't have all the answers. A lot of them aren't even asking the right questions. So if the world's going to get better, it's going to be up to you.
Here to look at what is going on between the two presidents and more are Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and host of Public Radio's Politics with Amy Walter, and Tamara Keith of NPR. She also co-hosts the NPR Politics podcast. Hello to both of you. So here we have the two presidents, but I want to preface this, Amy, by saying today, Attorney General William Barr stated, and we aired this earlier in the program, that he does not expect there to be criminal prosecution of either former President Obama or former Vice President Joe Biden, presumably over the Russia investigation. And yet that is what one of the main things President Trump has been going after President Obama, Vice President Biden over. Any idea why right now President Obama appeared to pick this moment to respond?
Well, it is interesting, Judy, you're right, that President Obama, using the one time we have seen him in this on this platform, as you said, for graduates, to make a not-so-veiled swipe at President Trump. But it was also, I thought, interesting this weekend. We saw a story in the Washington Post that said the Biden campaign is working very hard to basically turn the other cheek. They don't want to fall into the trap that so many other politicians since the rise of Donald Trump's candidacy in 2015 have fallen into, which is they try to engage him in these Twitter battles and they almost always lose. And at the same time, you have a lot of Democrats. We saw this in the primary, Judy, so many Democratic voters who are desperate to see their candidates go after Donald Trump in the way that Donald Trump goes after their candidates, goes after President Obama, goes after Joe Biden. Joe Biden doesn't want to do this. He knows that his brand essentially is empathy, compassion, sort of turning the other cheek, doing the right thing. That doesn't mean that other politicians can't do it for him. And so in this case, President Obama can be that person, can play that bad cop. I think you're going to see that a lot from whoever the vice presidential candidate of Joe Biden will be, the person who can take the attack directly to the president. But it's not coming from Joe Biden, the person who says he wants to restore decency to the White House.
So pick up on that, Tam. How smart is it for Joe Biden to be staying away from a fight, if you will?
Well, it's the path that they're taking now. Certainly covering Hillary Clinton's campaign, they fell into the trap a lot of fighting that fight with Donald Trump, and it didn't work. The people didn't know what she stood for because there were so many snarky tweets back at the Trump campaign, or thinking that Donald Trump doing the Trump thing, being brash and upsetting people, that was hurting him, and they wanted to focus attention on it, and it didn't actually help her. So the Biden campaign is trying to avoid some of those traps. President Trump is, in some ways, I mean, he has never stopped going after Barack Obama. I mean, his political career really got going with birtherism, and now you have, from birtherism to Obamagate, it is just continuing. It's of a piece. And And so you have the president of the United States attacking the former president. You have the former president sort of in a thinly veiled way. I mean, in some ways, former President Obama could have said a lot of things that no matter what he said would have been taken as a swipe against President Trump.
For sure. And it is, I mean, just as we said a minute ago, interesting that the attorney general himself is now saying he doesn't expect there to be criminal prosecution of President Obama, former Vice President Biden. But we'll see whether that slows down President Trump's use of the term Obamagate. Amy, in addition to all this, we saw the president, President Trump's sons ramping up their criticism this weekend. Eric Trump, the president's son, essentially saying that he thinks Democrats are behind the move to prevent opening up the country, that they're all behind the effort to keep people to stay at home because they want to prevent President Trump from campaigning. He said he thinks the day after the election, Democrats are going to admit that this whole stay-at-home business and the coronavirus was just really about nothing and everything's fine.
So what's that saying, Judy, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail? That has been the Trump campaign and the Trump presidency, everyone in Trump orbit's way of thinking constantly. It is a campaign of constant grievance. There's always somebody or something that is out to take out the president, undermine him, undermine people who support him or wear his gear. And so this is sort of what they know, and it's what they'll continue to do. But I think it also speaks to what we've been seeing in polling now for the last couple of months is the real divide that's opening up between Democrats and Republicans on how serious they think the coronavirus is. And Pew's been tracking this since March. Back in March, there was a 26-point gap between Democrats and Republicans on how serious do you think this is as a health crisis. It's now up to almost 40 points, that gap. When they ask people how well they think certain groups are doing tackling coronavirus, Republicans put the news media at 25%. They put Donald Trump at 77%. So again, it fits right into that mindset of many Republicans. But for the president, as we've seen from the very beginning, his ability to generate enthusiasm from his base, that's not a problem. To get more voters, including those who are ambivalent about him, to vote for him in 2020, that's a bigger problem.
And this device, Tam, of saying this is all part of a Democrat's plan, conspiracy, to keep the president from getting out and campaigning, that they're cynically using this coronavirus as an excuse.
It is a wild claim, but hey, guess what? There have been a lot of wild claims that have come from the president's sons on social media and in broadcast media as well. The president's sons are often willing to say things that the president doesn't say quite as overtly. He will tiptoe up to it. For the Trump campaign, sort of having conspiracy swirl out there works for them. They are creating an ecosystem for the president's supporters through an app, through social media channels. They're creating an ecosystem of information where there are no alternatives to the information that is coming from Trump and his surrogates. Amy says that it doesn't expand the base. Clearly, the Trump campaign's theory of the case here is they aren't really trying to expand the base. They are trying to just find people who were already part of the base that didn't vote last time.
That's right.
And all in the middle of a pandemic that is a deadly pandemic that has now killed, as we said, more than 90,000 Americans. Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, we thank you both.
You're welcome. Welcome.
Finally tonight, singing the coronavirus blues, if you will, Jeffrey Brown revisits a musician who has met many challenges with song in the past and now confronts one that is quite personal. The story is part of our ongoing American Creator series on rural arts and canvas.
With the sky that you look upon, oh,
I
Outside the Citadel Nursing Home in Salisbury, North Carolina, an uplifting one-woman performance. Singer, 63-year-old blues musician Pat Mother Blues Cohen.
It's been like a huge outbreak of the coronavirus, and everybody is in their rooms and everybody is afraid, and I want to do something that's gonna brighten up somebody's day. And in brightening somebody else's day, it brightens my day also.
The Citadel in Salisbury now considered the site of an outbreak.
The nursing home is the scene of one of North Carolina's worst outbreaks of COVID-19. Health officials say the 160-bed facility has had more than 150 confirmed cases among residents and staff. One of the residents, Pat Cohen's 59-year-old brother, George. He first went into the home 2 years ago after suffering a stroke. He's not been diagnosed with COVID, but is mostly confined to his bed and watches his sister perform through the window.
My brother used to help me with my equipment. He would carry it to my car for me. And I could always depend on him. So I'm doing the same thing for him.
My man give me steaks. Ain't that nice?
We first met Pat Cohen in 2014 at a gathering in Durham of the Music Maker Relief Foundation, an organization that supported more than 400 blues musicians around the South, mostly African American, often rural. People like Ironing Board Sam, who briefly reached the spotlight but never made it big, and eked out a living playing small clubs and busking on the streets. Music Maker helps these musicians meet basic needs, and for some has gotten them back to performing paying gigs. Now, founder Tim Duffy says, the shows have stopped. The fear is real.
They're scared. When you live, like an average check is like $600 to $800 a month, sometimes as low as $400 a month. All the artists that we're working with, a lot of them are between 75 and 85 and have diabetes. They're highly intelligent. And so, like, they'll tell me if I make a mistake, I might die, you know, if I touch the wrong thing. So they're being very, very careful, but that's a lot of pressure to live under.
A lot of artists and arts organizations are now looking to new models like streaming as a way to stay connected, also to possibly raise funds. Is that sort of thing possible for you and these artists?
It's possible, but there's a great digital divide. They're elderly. They don't know how to use the devices. A lot of places are in rural communities that don't have the best internet, so we can't do that.
Pat Cohen was once a regular on the New Orleans scene. She lost her home during Hurricane Katrina, along with her professional connections. Music Maker helped her relocate to North Carolina and pick up her career. She was scheduled to perform at Jazz Fest earlier this month, in fact, and in Portugal later on. But now all the gigs are gone, the money not coming in.
If all you do is sing or play an instrument or whatever it is, you don't know what you're going to do, because after this is over, if it's ever over, you wonder if it's ever going to be over. You don't know how things are going to change, and you know it's going to change. Will there ever be live concerts again?
She used to be paid to perform inside the nursing home. Now there's just singing outside to lift up her brother and others. Music Maker's Tim Duffy says it's another example of why the musicians he's worked with for 25 years deserve our respect and help.
She just, you know, keeps going, and now she literally has very little money, and she gets up the gumption to go out and sing for them and do something to help others with what she has. She has joy in her heart. She has music. And I think in times of crisis, we look for our folk musicians to guidance. That's their role, their bards.
Pat Mother Blues Cohen puts it this way.
Everybody has a currency, and everybody's currency is different. My currency is my voice. You don't have to do what I do, but do something nice for somebody else. And that makes you feel good, and that's contagious by itself.
Blues both sad and joyful, now comforting others in a time of pandemic. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
And singing to her brother, that is special. On the NewsHour online, right now, when an Alaska park department had to shut down local hiking, they didn't want to give their information hotline the boot. Instead, it's now a joke hotline and a source of smiles around the country. You can read more on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.